Award-winning journalist and foreign policy analyst Robin Wright is visiting Iowa this week. Wright has spent decades exploring new trends in the Islamic world. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll hear Robin Wright's take on the major policy challenges for the U.S. and the West in the coming years, including the Arab revolts and the rise of political Islam. Her latest book is titled, The Islamists Are Coming, Who They Really Are. Before that, in the first half hour, a conversation with incumbent Republican U.S. Congressman Tom Latham. He's facing another incumbent, Leonard Boswell, for Iowa's new 3rd District. That's all coming up after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This election season, we've invited all the Republican and Democratic candidates vying to represent Iowa's 4 new congressional districts to share their views. And my guest this half hour is incumbent 9-term Republican Tom Latham. He's facing 8-term Democratic incumbent Congressman Leonard Boswell. It's one of the rare instances in the country where 2 incumbents are facing each other due to redistricting, because Iowa lost 1 seat in the House, down from 5 to 4. The new 3rd District is comprised of 16 counties, covers some counties in central Iowa, including Polk and Dallas counties, as well as the southwest corner of the state. Congressman Latham joins us now. Welcome to our program.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be with you, Ben.
You've been serving in Congress since 1995, but you're a relative newcomer to many voters in this new 3rd District. How have you reintroduced yourself to voters in areas of the state that you haven't represented before?
Well, it's just been a matter of getting out, talking to people, going through each of the 16 counties, meeting new constituents, talking about the future of the country, and certainly the big issue with the national debt, the spending in Washington is on everyone's mind. And so as someone who's been effective as far as holding down spending in Washington, the message has been well received.
Let's talk a little bit about that. That will face Congress after the election is over. Will you vote to raise the debt ceiling, and under what conditions?
Well, I believe that we've got to make major changes, certainly with the spending. The 2/3 of the budget is on mandatory spending, and that has to be addressed. It's increasing about 8-9% every year. It simply is not sustainable. And when we get back in the lame duck session, in the lame duck session, you're going to see a lot of issues to be addressed, certainly with the taxes, with the sequestration at the end of the year. But the mandatory part of the budget is on autopilot, and we've got to, for the long term, make some real changes.
I wonder if you can be specific on the compromises you'd be willing to make on a budget deal to ensure that sequestration doesn't happen. Would you, for instance, support revenue increases, and in what form?
Well, when we're looking at what is happening at the end of the year with the fiscal cliff that we're looking at, the uncertainty with taxes, the major cuts that are going to go into place. The House actually has already addressed those issues as far as extending the current tax law for a year to give us time to do comprehensive tax reform, which would, in fact, increase revenues to the federal government with economic activity in the private sector. We've also addressed the major cuts that are going to come into place on January 2nd, and that is critical that we do that. We hope that the Senate will take some action when we get back after the election to address this, because it'll cost probably about 1 million jobs just almost overnight if, in fact, that's not addressed. But certainly with any kind of tax reform, you're going to see some increase in revenues with a tax code that actually works.
New jobs numbers are out from October, 171,000 new jobs created. That exceeds most estimates, expectations. Is this good news in your book?
Well, anytime there's more jobs, it certainly is is good news. The unemployment rate actually went up to 7.9. That's unacceptable. We've got to get this economy going. There's actually about 8 million people, fewer in the workforce entirely than what there were 4 years ago. People have given up, which is extremely unfortunate. If the same number of people were in the workforce as 4 years ago, the unemployment rate would be about 10.6. But, 7.9 is not acceptable. Anytime that we do have increase in hiring, that is great news. But there's a lot more that needs to be done and can be done.
Of course, after the election, Iowa farmers will be looking to Washington to get going and pass a farm bill. That didn't happen in the end of the last session. The vote is set for after the election. Where do you differ from Congressman Boswell on the farm bill?
Well, I'm not sure that we differ that much as far as the policies are concerned. I think both understand that the direct payments are not going to continue. There will be major changes as far as the countercyclical program. What we need to have, I believe, is to have a very viable risk management tool for farmers so that they can insure their potential losses and be able to keep them in business given that certainty. The biggest controversy, really, as far as passing the farm bill, is the fact that about 80% of that is feeding programs, nutrition programs, and they have increased dramatically in the last 4 years. And to basically level off as far as the spending, and it simply can't continue to increase at the rate it is. It simply is not sustainable.
Representative Latham, you and Representative Boswell are long-standing incumbents, long records together. I think the two of you have over 30 years of experience on Capitol Hill. You are both described as moderates in your respective parties. I wonder if you were to narrow the key differences between the two of you to one or two issues, what do you think are the key issues that the people in your district should be paying attention to?
Well, there are voting records to compare. Certainly, he has supported the Wall Street bailout, which really helped out Wall Street, but really hurt Main Street, another $1.2 trillion of spending in the stimulus package also that he supported. Much different view, I think, as far as spending, as far as the expansion of the federal government. The health care bill is something that is going to increase spending about $2.6 trillion over the next 10 years, about $800 billion of increased taxes. That he supported, and certainly with the $716 billion of cuts to Medicare to fund a new entitlement program for people not in Medicare is going to be very detrimental to access quality health care.
Let's talk a little bit more about health care in general. These have been big parts of this presidential campaign. If Governor Romney is elected to president, do you see a path and support a path to repeal the new health care law known to many as Obamacare?
Well, certainly, there's a broad bipartisan agreement for certain provisions of pre-existing conditions so that everyone has access, even if you do have some medical problems, that they're able to purchase insurance, taking off the caps on the catastrophic coverages, the major illnesses, allowing young people to stay on their parents' policies if they want them to through college, something that's totally in agreement. But where the portion that is in dispute, shall we say, is the approach as far as how you hold down costs. The president's health care bill does not hold down costs. We've already seen about a $2,500 increase in premiums that's scheduled for about another $2,500 for individual premiums the next couple of years. We've got to introduce, I think, competition into the marketplace, people able to purchase insurance across state lines, small businesses being able to join together to purchase insurance across the country and have the power to negotiate with the insurance companies to hold down costs. And certainly the medical malpractice part is a critical issue. That's about $50 billion a year of costs.
So would
and
you?
Ben, I want to apologize. I've been on the road here in our Winnebago for 5 days and talking. We've done about 40 some stops already, and I'm losing my voice.
we can still hear you loud and clear, Congressman. Okay. Thank you for. For doing this, even though you have a tight schedule there with a lot of things tugging at you. I'm just curious, where do you live within the district, the new 3rd District?
I live in Clive. That's where Kathy, my wife, and I lived when we first got married 37 years ago. We lived there for a year, and we love being back in Clive again. It's a great, great place, certainly on the west side of Des Moines there.
Have you made a commitment to spend a certain amount of time in the new 3rd District, getting to know the issues important to your constituents if you're elected?
Well, I have always done town meetings in all the communities. I've done about 540 town hall meetings. I think the form of government we have, it's representational. It's very important for me to be out there listening, so that I can take the ideas, thoughts, and concerns of Iowans, people in the 3rd District, back to Washington. I think most people think they've probably heard enough out of Washington. They'd rather have Washington listening to them rather than being dictated from Washington.
I'm looking for a number. Do you have a specific time that you dedicate to being in your district to hear those views?
Oh, yeah. I come home every weekend and always out in the district, either doing town hall meetings or meeting with constituents. So it's just an ongoing process that I do now and will continue to do.
You have voiced support for the wind energy tax credit, despite the fact that your party's presidential candidate nominee, Mitt Romney, said he will let it expire. What are you willing to do, Congressman Latham, to ensure this tax credit, which is important to Iowa's economy, is extended?
Well, what we need to do when we get back after the election, there will be a package of tax extenders is what it's called. There's about 70 of those that need to be extended before the first of the year. We're going to push very, very hard to make sure that the wind tax credit is in that package, that we have certainty going forward as to what that credit will look like. I think the industry itself certainly understands that long-term, it's probably not sustainable. What we need to do is work with the industry to find out what will keep them successful, to keep that industry that's so vital for the state of Iowa going. And, Governor Romney does not want to have new tax credits, but he's certainly not going to cut off the tax credits that are in place today.
You do not support a federal gas tax increase. Your opponent,
right,
Representative Boswell, disagrees. He says on this point that his argument, we cannot afford to have our infrastructure crumbling. We need those revenues by a raised gas tax for roads, bridges. Do you agree that our roads and bridges are badly in need of repair? And how would you propose to pay for them, if not with a gas tax increase?
Well, we have obviously huge infrastructure needs in this country. I chair the Transportation and HUD Subcommittee on Appropriations. I'm keenly aware of the needs that are there. The authorization that was just put in place for 2 years has authorization for about $39.7 billion a year for the federal government to pay the states. Revenues are only about $27 billion. And so we're taking money basically out of the general fund right now to pay for the obligation that was in the new highway bill. And that's where it really should have been addressed if it was going to be. I believe that a gas tax increase is very regressive, and especially when you look at a state like Iowa, a very rural state. We have people, I just was at Pella Windows down in Shenandoah yesterday talking to the employees, and over half of them drive more than 20 miles to work every day. Increasing the gas tax on them is taking away disposable income that they could use for their families. And also, you have to understand with the new vehicle efficiencies. There's less gas per mile being used. We have hybrid vehicles who don't pay as much, obviously, in gas tax. You have electric vehicles that pay nothing. We've got to find another source of revenue where everybody who uses the infrastructure will actually contribute to it. And so there are different ways of doing it, whether you talk about miles driven, whether you talk about the type of registration fees, things like that. But simply to raise the tax in a state like Iowa is very, very regressive.
If you've just joined us, my guest is nine-term Republican incumbent Tom Latham. He's running against eight-term Democratic incumbent Congressman Leonard Boswell for the new 3rd District to represent Iowa's new 3rd District. And Congressman Latham, we have just a few minutes left, I know. Women's issues have figured prominently in the national discussion this election cycle. You voted against the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act back in 2009, which extends the statute of limitation for filing an equal pay lawsuit regarding pay discrimination. Right. Why did you vote against that?
Well, my wife, my two daughters, my granddaughter, it's absolutely critical that they have, being treated fairly, equally. The form of that bill when it came out basically was just more for litigation than it was to actually improve the situation. What we really need to have is a thriving, growing economy that's going to have opportunities for everyone in the workforce, and so that everyone gets equal pay. And there's no question about that, and that's something I truly believe in. But this really was a way of just having a vehicle for more lawsuits. There's no statute of limitation. So something that happened 20 years ago, they could go back and sue for.
The point was made that sometimes women do not know they're being discriminated against in this way for many years after the fact. It comes to light maybe 7-10 years later, and then they can't litigate. So you're okay with that?
Well, the fact of the matter is, what we need to have in this is a growing economy, so that there is demand out there, there is competition for those jobs, and quite honestly, people coming out of college, out of training today, it is fair and equal as far as the payment of the wages that people earn today.
Mm-hmm. Let's say we have the election results, more or less the status quo. You're reelected. You represent the 3rd District instead of the 4th. President Obama is reelected. The House stays in the GOP's hands. The Senate stays in Democratic hands. Can you imagine we'd have anything different than the gridlock that we've had the last 4 years and the next 4 years? Will the dynamics change in your estimation?
Well, it hasn't been gridlock for 4 years. The president's party had total control 2 years ago and for that Congress. I think the people have to understand that we have extraordinarily serious problems when you talk about the national debt, when you talk about creating jobs, getting this economy going. I'm very hopeful, and I have to be optimistic that no matter what happens on Tuesday, that people will actually sit down, put people before politics, and really, progress before partisanship. That's what we have to do. That's been my record as far as working in Congress. I was very proud of the fact that Des Moines Register named me the most effective member of the Iowa House delegation, and it's simply because I do work on both sides and really to get things done rather than just talk about them.
You have had a significant fundraising edge in this race, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. You've raised, more than twice as much as Leonard Boswell. What difference has this made in the campaign?
Well, it's enabled us to get our message out, to fight off the very, very negative personal attacks that have come our way. And, it's kind of been the mode of operation with Congressman Boswell going with Brad Zahn and previous campaigns to attack personally. I've been talking about issues. It's allowed us to be able to get our message out there and to tell the truth about what the real record is.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned negative campaign ads. This has undoubtedly, you would probably agree, distracted from more important issues. What issues haven't been talked about enough because of the negative campaign ads and the focus on them?
Well, I think we should be talking about what we're going to do in the future and how we're going to get this economy growing stronger, to look at the regulatory burden today that small businesses have. It's been crushing for them. They're very concerned going forward about what else is going to come down as far as new regulations. We should be talking about tax policy, how we have a more competitive tax code where we could actually increase revenues by having a tax code that actually would encourage people to invest, hire more people. And those are the issues that really people are concerned about. The national debt, taxes, regulatory burden, and, the economy and job creation.
When you talk about your legislative record, what do you look back on in your many years of work in Capitol Hill as your proudest legislative accomplishment?
Well, there are several different things I'm very, very proud of. One that I think stands out to me is very important for our folks in the National Guard and Reserves. Prior to my legislation, that we worked on a very bipartisan basis with the Democrat Gene Taylor from Mississippi, actually Hillary Clinton in the Senate, and Lindsey Graham in the Senate, was to have access to health insurance in the military for those people in the Guard and Reserve when they're not deployed. Previously, they would have insurance while they were deployed overseas, but then it would go away when they came home. What our legislation did was give them access while they're home and drilling in the Guard and the Reserve, that they would have access to health insurance. So I'm very, very proud of that. There are many other things. Look at the National Animal Disease Center up in Ames that we fought for. It took about 6 years to get it totally completed, but that's a major, major center up there, recognized internationally as far as animal health. And I'm very, very proud that we got that facility modernized.
And finally, Congressman Latham, you've certainly faced re-election many, many times, but not like this, incumbent versus incumbent. Looking back on this 2012 campaign, what will you remember most?
Well, the thing that I really enjoy is going out and meeting folks and talking about issues, listening to people, and that will always be the highlight for me, is just the interaction I have with constituents. My job is to represent folks in Washington, and the only way you can do that is to listen, have conversations. We're not always going to agree, but I listen to everybody's point of view, and I learn everything from the constituents.
Congressman Latham, we thank you very much for making the time for us. Thank you very much, Congressman.
You bet. Take care.
Coming up in just a moment, award-winning journalist and foreign policy analyst Robin Wright will join us. She spoke at Iowa State University yesterday evening. Her many works explore new trends in the Islamic world, and these will be major policy challenges, she says, for the United States and the West in the coming years, including the Arab revolts, the rise of political Islam, and the counter-jihad against extremism. Foreign policy analyst Robin Wright in just a moment, and River to River continues. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My next guest is award-winning journalist and foreign policy analyst Robin Wright. Yesterday evening, Wright spoke at Iowa State University. Her many works explore new trends in the Islamic world that will be major policy challenges for the U.S. and the West in the coming years, including the Arab revolts, the rise of political Islam, and the counter-jihad against extremism. Her latest book is titled, The Islamists Are Coming, Who They Really Are. In 2011, she wrote the book, Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. It won the 2012 Overseas Press Club Award for Best Book on International Affairs. She also edited The Iran Primer, Power Politics and U.S. Policy in 2010. Robin Wright, welcome to our program.
It's great to be with you.
Number of issues to talk with you today about. President Obama is having to answer critics who have accused his administration of orchestrating some kind of cover-up over this latest September 11th attack in Libya. Now, if we remember, the aftermath of the attack killed four Americans. The administration initially sought to blame the deaths on a riot that was sparked by this anti-Muslim video. The intelligence community later reversed itself, admitting the attacks were pre-planned and likely the work of terrorists or militants. President Obama has vowed to hold individuals in his administration responsible at the conclusion of the investigation if they're found negligent. What is your read on what happened and the charges against the administration?
Well, I was in Libya last week, and the ambassador who died in the consulate in Benghazi was a close personal friend of mine dating back more than 20 years. So I take this issue very, very seriously. But I think that it's fully understandable that there were conflicting versions of events. I lived in Beirut for 5 years during the first bombing of the American embassy, then the Marine compound, and then a second American embassy. And I've covered this extremism now for 30 years. And the first version is often what kind of appears to be logical, but it often isn't based on all the facts being in. And I think the investigation is still ongoing. I've talked to several officials in Libya, and of course you're dealing with a society and a government in transition, still groping just to get a cabinet approved and only elected in July. And they're doing their best to try to help the United States figure out who is responsible and why. But it doesn't surprise me at all that there have been conflicting versions. I don't think it has anything to do with this administration. I think whether it's Republicans or Democrats in the past, the Reagan administration in the 1980s, often don't know all the facts within 24 hours. It takes a long time to reconstruct really what happened.
Mm-hmm. Senator McCain, I think, said yesterday either it's a cover-up or incompetence on the administration's part.
Well, I find that offensive. In fact, I find the whole politicalization of this tragedy offensive. Terrorism is something that, it's like 9/11. It took a long time to put all the pieces together. Who were the 15 people who flew into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon? Nobody knows these things right away. And I think that's jumping to a conclusion to say it's either incompetence or a cover-up. I don't think anybody's covering up anything. I think the investigation is still ongoing, and as it does after every single terrorist attack.
Let's turn our focus to Iran, also in the news, and you've covered Iran for many years. A lot of concern, of course, about Iran acquiring nuclear weapons, also concern about a possible preemptive strike by Israel, what the U.S. should do in this case. Describe the U.S. policy, if you could, toward Iran and whether you think that's been effective.
Well, the Obama administration has continued in many ways what the Bush administration did, started, and that was a series of very punitive sanctions against Iran, trying to squeeze it economically. At the same time, we now know that there have been some rather imaginative covert operations reportedly against Iran's nuclear program with cyber attacks that have hurt Iran's ability to enrich uranium. We don't know the full scope of intelligence operations and probably won't for a long time. The military option is clearly on the table. Both the administration, both Obama and the Romney foreign policy position is that the military option is on the table down the road. But both U.S. intelligence and Israeli intelligence believe that Iran has not yet made the decision to weaponize its nuclear program. One of the things that's a little bit hard for those who are not nuclear physicists to understand is that uranium enrichment is just one of three different elements that have to be pulled together to create a nuclear weapon. Iran has been working on one of those, and that's uranium enrichment, the fuel, basically, for either a peaceful nuclear energy program or a weapon. And we all know that Iran has done some very suspicious things. We don't have all the smoking gun to justify a military attack to date. And I think there's a bit of sensitivity, rightly so, in light of the fact that the U.S. Believed Iraq had a weapons of mass destruction program, and of course, nothing was ever found. So I think everyone is moving rather slowly. The election has, I think, put off another round of diplomatic activity. I suspect we'll see another attempt after the election, whether it's by the Obama administration or the Romney administration, because that's we haven't yet gone as far as we can in squeezing Iran.
Mm-hmm. What's left?
Oh, there are a lot of things. First of all, remember that the United States and the European Union have put very tough punitive sanctions on Iran, but the Chinese and the Russians have not gone nearly as far, and they have blocked more efforts by the United Nations, and that still is a place for additional sanctions down the road. So we haven't expended that. You know, one of the things we really all have to consider is the consequences of a third war in the Middle East in just a decade or 12 years, and the price that this country would pay, whether it's in national treasure or human beings, that and the image of the United States globally, it's not something that we can take on unilaterally again, even if we don't have others in a coalition with us, that if that option is exercised, there has to be general approval by at least our allies, and we're not there yet either.
My guest this hour, journalist and foreign policy analyst Robin Wright. So in the case of Iran, what are the most likely scenarios you see as possible going forward?
Well, I think we probably have up to another year before there have to be bigger decisions made, a year in which there are further diplomatic efforts. I don't, at this stage, I don't think Iran is in a place where it's willing to compromise. But I think that its economy is also in terrible trouble, in part because of its own mismanagement, but also because of the impact of all kinds of sanctions. The Bush administration actually came up with an interesting idea to sanction banks. It has nothing to do with the nuclear program. It has to do with good banking practices. Banks internationally now, after 9/11, have to be able to account for where all money has come from, not just one step removed, but all the way back. And if banks do not comply with these new international laws, then they are sanctioned. And that's what the United States has orchestrated around the world by over 100 major financial institutions, including in China, that they're not doing business. And this makes it hard for Iran to work in dollars, just basically in importing or exporting, but also to get letters of credit for its own industries and its businesses. So that has been a slow squeeze mm-hmm. on Iran as well.
So the likely outcome you see here is that at one point Iran gives up.
Well, look, we're all hoping that Iran will compromise. We don't see the signs that it will yet, but additional pressure may hurt it. Remember, Iran also goes through a presidential election next summer in June, and President Ahmadinejad cannot run again. There's a two-term limit, just as there is in the United States, four years in each term. And Iran is going to be facing the same kind of quandary that the United States has, and which slows everything down as the nation decides on who the next executive will be.
Robin Wright, let's broaden this discussion out a little bit and have you, in broad terms, evaluate President Obama's first term of successes and failures in your area of study in the Middle East, the Arab world. What would you say are those successes and failures?
Well, obviously, getting Osama bin Laden is one of the most remarkable achievements. This is something the Bush administration and the Obama administration had both tried to do, and the Obama administration made a pretty bold decision in deciding to go ahead and launch an operation when they weren't completely sure that the facility where bin Laden was living actually was where he was based. So that was a brave decision. And one of the hardest, I think, was recognizing in the Middle East that the United States would have to walk away from some of its longstanding allies, whether it was President Mubarak in Egypt, President Ben Ali in Tunisia, that there was a recognition that the time had come to recognize people power and to walk away from people the United States has invested in, both politically and financially, in terms of providing aid. That was, I think, a smart decision. I think one of the failures is not moving forward on the Arab-Israeli peace process. This is an issue that has now flared since almost the end of the world of World War II, and every administration has tried to make progress, and the Obama administration has paid very little attention to this issue.
Mm-hmm. And so in the next term, whether it's a President Obama continuing or President Romney, there will be a new initiative, undoubtedly, you think?
I think so. This is something that is tremendously important to the broader American interests in the Middle East. As long as that conflict is not resolved, there is tension between the United States and some of the Arab nations. U.S. credibility is on the line. And at the end of the day, the United States will have to play some role, as it has in the past, with both Egypt and Jordan making peace with Israel. So I think that there will be. It's always easier during a second term for a president to try to broker major achievements in foreign policy because he doesn't have to worry about what price he might pay in the next round of elections.
In regards to Afghanistan, would you put that in the success column for President Obama in his actions there?
Well, I think getting out of Iraq was an important achievement. We'd run our course there, and I think the decision to withdraw from Afghanistan is one that any president would probably have made. Again, this is the longest war. It's been tremendously costly, and we have very little to show for it except for the death of bin Laden. So there are no good options, frankly, on Afghanistan. And so at least putting a date on it is the beginning. But I think there's also a growing interest in getting out even sooner.
Ralph Nader was on this program a couple of weeks ago, and on issues related to the military and foreign policy, he says that President Obama is worse than George W. Bush, quote, in the sense that he's more aggressive, more illegal worldwide. He spoke specifically about the use of drones. What's your reaction to that position?
Well, drones are very controversial. This is a whole new instrument in warfare. And it's a way of avoiding putting troops on the ground. It's using technology. I mean, it's astounding that pilots using, that are not really pilots, but, basically techies who a continent away can steer a drone attack on suspected targets is an astounding capability. Needless to say, we've had a lot of missed calls where civilians have died in the process, including, at weddings and so forth. And so these are this is a very controversial tactic, but it's also cost efficient, and it has eliminated some senior Al-Qaeda and Taliban operatives operating not just in Afghanistan but in Pakistan and Yemen as well. There are many governments that find the use of this very difficult. The Pakistani government has taken a very strong stand against the American use of drones. But this again is where if you have to engage in some kind of military operation, is it preferable to use American troops and put their lives on the line or to try to engage in a strike by a remote mm-hmm. drone?
What about the case that is made that Ralph Nader makes, too, that it doesn't even... It may kill militants along with some civilians, but it's also stirs up anti-American sentiment. It helps the recruiting of those who would like to do America harm.
I think that's probably true, but I also think that putting troops on the ground in countries where we don't have the legal right to do that will also generate hostility. And it's a question of which generates greater resentment. The presence of American troops, which, you know, some people would call, whether it's a special force operation, might call it an invasion, or it also could be a breach legally. And again, they're in warfare, there are a lot of nasty options, and none of them have enormous appeal, but some of them are either cost efficient or, cost efficient in terms of either human life or national treasure. And given the expenditures on warfare over the past 10 years, hundreds of billions of dollars, drones do have a certain appeal.
How do you see Syria at this point? Who stands to lose or gain when that eventually, that outcome, will it be the fall of Assad?
Syria is really such a tragedy. Syria is the strategic center of the Arab world in the same way that Egypt is the political or intellectual center of the Arab world. Syria borders so many countries, whether it's Israel or Jordan or Turkey, which are all strong U.S. allies. It's very close to the Gulf. And, of course, it's the current government is Iran's closest ally in the Arab world. It is just incredibly important to the future of the Middle East. And it is a travesty that 30,000 people are estimated to have died since this campaign began almost 20 months ago. I do not believe that Bashar Assad can survive politically long term. The question is, how many thousands of people could die before there is some denouement? He has proven that he is willing to violate every international treaty, the barometers of human rights, and to do anything for the Assad dynasty to remain in power. The Assad father and son have controlled Syria now for more than 40 years, and I just don't see any way he can survive. But the Syrians are also deeply divided among themselves, whether it's the rebel force or the opposition leadership, which is operating from exile. And that complicates things. In Libya, you at least had one body that operated inside the country and that spoke with national legitimacy. That's not true of the Syrian National Council that's operating from outside Syria. And the fact that the Syrians can't form a government in exile with a common agenda, they're squabbling among themselves all the time. And that makes it very hard for the outside world to justify any kind of help, be it the creation of humanitarian corridors or arming some of the rebel forces.
Your latest book, Robin Wright, is titled The Islamists Are Coming, Who They Really Are. So we have a couple minutes left. Tell us who they really are.
Well, the interesting thing is that the Islamist parties are now the most dynamic and energetic political forces across the Arab world. But they are not of one mind, one position, one movement. There is a whole new political spectrum just among the Islamists. In Egypt, for example, you have the Muslim Brotherhood, which is 84 years old, and you have the new Salafi Nur Party. The Salafis are the new political phenomena in the region. They share the common goals of al-Qaeda in taking the region back to the purity of the early years of the Islamic Empire in the 7th century. But most of them, not all of them, but most of them renounce violence. They favor different kinds of tactics. They want to work within the system rather than to destroy it from outside. And the two Islamist factions in Egypt are real rivals. One of the parties is willing to work with the outside world and even work with Israel, whereas the Nur party, the Salafis, think of the Muslim Brotherhood as basically Muslim yuppies. They think they've compromised Islamic principles and have abandoned, Islamic institutions, whereas the Nur Party is viewed by the Muslim Brotherhood as naive and extremist. So they're real rivals for political parties. We can't and shouldn't assume that all Islamists agree, and that's an important distinction.
Would you say that's the biggest misconception perhaps we have in our popular press in the United States, that it's one block, a monolithic movement?
Absolutely. And the irony is that there are some Islamists who have the same agenda as the United States and its Western allies, and that is to contain extremism. And it's very interesting to see some of the Islamist-led governments, notably in Tunisia, going after some of the extremist Islamists. In some places, some of these Islamic groups may prove to be more effective than the United States is in containing extremism.
Okay. Journalist, foreign policy analyst Robin Wright, we want to thank you for joining us this half hour.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. Thank you.